Rabbi Simcha Weinberg, the immediate class following Yom Kippur, right before Sukkot, 2007, at Eishet Torah.
As a unit, it was incredible. We started dancing spontaneously. It was just otherworldly for everyone. No one wanted to leave.
Let me pan real quick so you can see your other friends who are here. Unfortunately, we have kind of a limited camera, so I can't really get the whole wide angle, but that's...
Let's start the clock.
Rabbi Cohen, so you can stand now if you want to.
I did. I stopped. Okay, should we start?
Yes.
Okay, if you would examine the mitzvahs from a halakhic perspective, from a purely halakhic perspective, of all the mitzvahs, which is the one that halakha considers mechanically the most difficult? Anyone?
Pesach.
Mechanically?
Mechanically. So someone said Pesach, okay.
Sukkah. Building a sukkah.
Which part is, why building a sukkah?
Because it involves your whole being.
But how does halakha describe it as the most mechanically challenging?
It's all the different parameters.
Everything is. What about shechita? You like to eat your meat. We people used to chef know that it's a lot more complicated.
Rav Simcha, you obviously haven't seen me trying to put up the sukkah.
Well, I believe that that's one of the side effects of having a wooden leg.
But that's only on Simcha's Torah.
Okay. Well, whoever it was who said sukkah is correct. If you look from a purely halakhic perspective, the most challenging of all mitzvahs to mechanically prepare for is sukkah, and I'll prove it to you. What happens if you have an open gap of a little less than three hand breaths? What's the halakha? Do you have an opening or not?
Yes.
No.
No, four.
It's called kavod. You may not see it, but when Moshe Rabbeinu was on Har Sinai, Hashem said, well, if less than three hand breaths, three tefachim, love it. There's no problem. It's covered. What happens if I have an awning sticking out of the side of my house so the wall of the house does not actually touch the sukkah because the awning is in the way? What do you say? There's no awning there. If it's less than four amos, then don't worry about it because that's not an awning. The wall is bending toward the sky. Dolphin akuma, the wall is bent. Right? Yeah. And you can use it as one of the walls of your sukkah. And what happens if you have four poles that are just sticking up from the bottom and they don't go all the way to the top? You're wrong. Good asik, good akis. The poles go all the way up. You know what I mean? It's like the famous story of the guy who built the sukkah using all these different halakos, and he was robbed. So the police came and they said, well, of course you were robbed. There's no wall here. He said, what do you mean there's no wall? Dolphin and akuma, the wall is bent. You just don't see it. He said, there's an open space. No, that's not an open space. Lover, you know, it's less than three tefachim. Not a problem. Why? In this halakha, more than any other, do you have all of these imaginary walls, as if the wall is bent, as if the open space is not there. Everything is as if on sukkah. In fact, why do we shake lulav and esrog 7 days? Where did they originally shake lulav and esrog the whole yantif? In the Beis HaMikdash. Only in the Beis HaMikdash. Otherwise, they just did it on the first day. So why do we shake all yontif as if we were in the Beis HaMikdash? So the first principle, even of sukkahs, comes even as we're building our sukkah. And that principle is called as if. Because the only way that we can take everything we achieved over Rosh Hashanah, the Aseres Yimei Teshuvah, and Yom Kippur, is to have the capacity to think of ourselves as if I can be what I can continue to be what I was on Yom Kippur. As if I can see myself and I look at myself and I wonder, it still feels that I have the same imperfections that I had before Yom Kippur, but I have to see myself as if they are not there. The first principle of Sukkot begins as we're building the Sukkah. As if. And this is actually at the crux of the most famous machlokes, the most famous debate between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer about the nature of the Sukkos we're trying to remember. The Gemara in Sukkah on Yud Aleph 11 describes this debate between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva. When the verse says that we should remember the Sukkos that Hashem provided for us when we were in the desert, so Rabbi Eliezer says these Sukkos were clouds. Every one of us had a home made out of clouds, and those clouds formed a hut around us that were perfect. Perfect cooling, perfect heating, everything was cleansed, our clothes were cleansed, our shoes didn't wear out, and those are the Sukkos we're remembering, clouds. Rabbi Akiva says, no way. It's not clouds. Hashem provided us with the necessary materials to actually build huts. And what we're remembering are the huts that we had around us. If you think about it, this is actually a machlokes about how far we can take as if. Think about it. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva have another machlokes in a different place. And that machlokes is, are we able to damin and we judge efshar, what is possible, mishe'i efshar, from what is not possible. So Rabbi Eliezer says, you are allowed to judge something that is impossible from something that is possible. So in other words, it is impossible for us to bring clouds. It's impossible. But we can judge it, we can do what we're doing, because the impossible does not matter. Danin efshar mishar lo efshar. It's impossible to bring the same clouds we had in the desert. It doesn't matter. We can do something physical and use our imagination to understand that these are actually the impossible things, which are the clouds that were provided. Rabbi Akiva's policy throughout his halachic decisions is very practical. And he says, Ein danin efshar mishalo efshar. Because it is impossible to actually bring clouds of glory, so it wouldn't make sense to build a physical sukkah and say that in doing so, we are remembering clouds of glory. It's impossible. And therefore, if the verse says that we have to remember the sukkahs that were provided in the desert, it must be physical sukkahs, because God would not give us an impossible task to build a physical sukkah to connect to something that is physically impossible for us. But if you think about this machlokes, by the way, you'll see that it's deeply rooted in the different ways that both Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva became whom they became. And, you know, that's Rabbi Cohen, you'll explain the stories, I'm sure. But if you look, Rabbi Akiva is the very hard, tenacious worker who goes at 40 years old to a cheder to learn Aleph Beis. He does everything in the most practical ways. Whereas Rabbi Eliezer cries. And his cry is so potent that in just a few meetings with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he is able to leap forward to do the impossible. So we know this concept of as if. And then we learn of this machlokes between Rabbi Eliezer, who says, learn the impossible from the possible. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, don't reach for the impossible. I believe that in general, the halachos of Sukkah follow the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, of Rabbi Eliezer, which is why we are always focused on the clouds. The whole idea of a Sukkah is not only as if, to use my imagination to see Oh, the wall is bent. It's not really an awning. It's a bent wall. But it will only be a bent wall for Sukkot, because the minute Sukkot is over, it'll be an awning. Or there's no empty space there for the days of Sukkot. But the minute Sukkot is over, yeah, there'll be an empty space. But right now it's not there. As if that wall is bent, as if I am who I was on Rosh Hashanah, on Tzom Gedaliah, on Aseret Yemei Teshuvah, and on Yom Kippur. And Danim Efshar Mishelo Efshar. Let us do what is possible, even though what we are trying to create is the impossible, it doesn't matter. A Jew on Sukkot is able to grasp for the Efshar, even what we consider to be impossible. And then think how impossible it would seem to us to be able to recreate the clouds of glory. We learn in many, many places that the clouds of glory appeared in whose merit?
Aaron.
Aaron HaKohen. I suspect that if Rabbi Cohen is answering the questions, that counts as cheating.
I just want to keep things moving. I waited.
If you think about it, yesterday, those of you who bowed down disagreed with that. Because the Yerushalmi says in the third parak of Yoma, the seventh Mishnah, that the only people who actually bowed when the Kohen Gadol used the name of Hashem were the people who were standing next to the Kohen Gadol. But if you were not actually standing next to the Kohen Gadol, you did not bow. All you did was say the verse Baruch Shem Kavod, etc., etc. So why do we bow? Where do we learn this idea of bowing? So think about it. Moshe Rabbeinu says to Hashem, V'niflinu, he's arguing after the Ega, and he's saying to Hashem, listen, you're telling me that you don't want to wipe these people out. That's not fair. We had a deal. You never told me that they, you know, if they mess up, that I'm not going to lead them. You presented this as a fact that I would take them out, I would lead them to Israel. Now you're changing your mind. So therefore, what you need to do is not only to forgive us, but I want more. V'niflinu aniva amaka, we want to be different from everyone else in the world, and we want you to make that concept manifest. In other words, everyone must know that we have a relationship with you that is different from every other relationship the nations may have with you or with their idols. So Hashem appears to Moshe, and what does Moshe do when Hashem appears? Vayimaher Moshe hurried up, Vayikod Arza, and he prostrated himself on the ground, Vayishdako, and he bowed down. So the Brisker Rav says, why do we bow down? Because when there is a revelation of the Shekhinah, you bow down. So think about it. On Yom Kippur, if we are just hearing the name of Hashem, then what we do is say Baruch Shem. The only people who bow down are those who are bowing down in the presence of the Shekhinah. So when we bow down on Yom Kippur, instead of just crying out Baruch Shem, what are we saying? We are not just hearing the name of Hashem, but we are literally standing in the presence of the Shekhinah. So this is already a concept. The Shekhinah that we will bring to the Sukkah on Sukkot is already a reality for us on Yom Kippur, because otherwise we would not bow. The only ones who bowed were the ones who were in the actual presence of the Shekhinah. We bowed. You bowed. That means that you held, that you were literally standing in the presence of the Shekhinah. So immediately after Yom Kippur, we go outside and we begin to build our Sukkah. Because we, who had to bow, who are obligated to bow because we not only heard the name of Hashem, which would demand that we say Baruch Shem, but we actually were standing in the presence of the Shekhinah, we know what the Shekhinah is. And because we know what the Shekhinah is, and we experience standing in the presence of the Shekhinah so much, we can take that experience and use it to build our Sukkah. So we have the as-if idea, which is that we can be whatever we were. We have the idea of being able to create the impossible. And once we have as if, and once we have the halakhic reality of Dunin Efshar, Misha Efshar, even if we believe something is impossible, halakha says it is possible, the first thing we have to realize is that we, who had to bow because we were in the presence of the Shekhinah, can take that very Shekhinah and use it when we build our sukkahs, whether last night or whether now, between Yom Kippur and Sukkot. That cloud that forced Moshe Rabbeinu to bow, that cloud is in the merit of Moshe. The six clouds are in the merit of Aaron, the six clouds that surrounded us. But there was a seventh cloud that was the presence of Moshe Rabbeinu. You can look up the Ramban on that pasuk in chapter 34, verse 10 of Shemos. You can look up the Ramban, and if you look up the Vilna Gaon, you'll see that he's incredible. He says that the Shekhinah was only there until they crossed the Yom Sof. And that, or there's a way to read him that he says the only one who understood the Shekhinah was in the seventh cloud was Moshe Rabbeinu. But once Moshe said this tefillah to Hashem, V'niflinu ani ra'amakar, we must be different. You must be manifest in our presence so that everyone knows that we are different. Then the Shekhinah appeared in the cloud to all who were present. And this is halachically and conceptually true. Why, how does the Gemara in Shabbos, the Gemara in Yevamos, the Gemara in Nedarim, how do they all describe the process of conversion? What do we say about a convert? He who is coming, lachasos, tachas, kanfei hashkinah. That one who comes to convert is coming to be wrapped and protected by the presence. So we treat it as a halachic reality. We learn this from Rus, because what does Boaz say to Rus? God should repay you for everything you did. Ashabas lachsos tachas kinafav. You came to wrap yours, to be wrapped and to be protected under his wings. So this idea of being able to take the Shekhinah and use it as a reality is halakhically true. And it's someone, we use it specifically for someone who converts, someone who's making a life-changing decision, a choice, for someone who wants a relationship with God, is choosing to give up the past and choose the future so that this person can have a relationship with God. So I would think that the way we bring the Shekhinah to the Sukkah is not only to imagine ourselves taking the Shekhinah that we experienced in Yom Kippur when we had to bow down. We were obligated to bow down because we were not just hearing, but we were standing in God's presence and we had to bow, much as Moshe Rabbeinu had to bow when Hashem revealed himself at the greatest revelation of Hashem to Moshe. We are able to take that if we use the time between Yom Kippur and Sukkot to do what a convert does. Lachasos tachas kamfei shekhinah. That we want to sit and dwell under the wings of the Shekhinah. So when we're putting up the schach, and the schach, as the pasuk in Yeshayahu says, is a symbol of God hovering over us, literally the Shekhinah hovering over us, as we're putting up the schach, it's not just as if God's presence is there. It's not just that we believe Halakha tells us nothing is impossible. It is telling us we can take the Shekhinah from Yom Kippur, the one in front of which we bow down, and we can literally infuse the schach that is on top of our sukkah with that Shekhinah. And we can do it simply by making the same choice that Rus makes, or that any convert makes, which is Rachasos Tachas Kamfei Hashkinah. Hashem, when I sit in this sukkah, all I want is to feel that I am sitting under the presence of the Shekhinah, the cloud of glory that appeared in the sake of Moshe, to Moshe, in which all the Jewish people were able to see the presence of Hashem. Sounds difficult, doesn't it? To literally do it? So there may be as if, and it may be that Halakha tells us the impossible is possible, but think for a second. The Jews had their opportunity with the first Luchos, and they made a serious mistake. They made the Ego. And when they made the Ego, they lost everything. They lost the Luchos. They lost this unbelievable level and intensity of relationship with Hashem. And then Hashem says, you know what? Make a Mishkan, make a Mikdash, and you will be able to bring the Shekhinah back. And everyone is desperate to do it. You know that it was the most successful fundraising campaign in history. It's the time when Erwin Katzoff appeared as a Chumash. And there was too much money. They had to stop. And so, and may all Aish fundraisers have that problem. They finished the sukkah. Moshe Rabbeinu puts it up. If you look at the closing paragraph of Sefer Shemos, an incredible thing happens. Vayichas he'anan es oil moed. They finally finish putting together the Mishkan. They're desperate to know, is it true? Can we actually bring the presence of God to a building? Yes, we followed all instructions, but to think that what we had at Sinai, we can have in a building that we made, they're wondering. And a cloud comes and covers the Mishkan. U'chavod Adonai malei et ha-Mishkan. And the glory of Hashem filled the Mishkan. And wow, this is incredible. So now, can we use it? How does it work? You may have taught us all the rules, but now we're seeing it. We're seeing literally the Shekhinah filling the Mishkan. So Moshe tries to go and enter the Mishkan. Even Moshe Rabbeinu could not enter. The divine presence was so manifest that even Moshe, Kishakan Alav Ha'anan, the cloud was there. Moshe could not get through. U'chavod Adonai malei et ha-Mishkan. And the glory of Hashem filled the Mishkan. Even Moshe could not. Unbelievable. Hashem tells them to start building the Mishkan. And by the way, why is it Sukkot is on the 15th of Tishrei? Why the 15th of Tishrei of all days? Why not Pesach time? Because the clouds left. They came back when they began to work on the Mishkan. Because Hashem said, oh, you're creating a house for me, I will create a house for you. Moshe came down in the 10th of Tishrei, Yom Kippur, with the second Luchos. That's where we were yesterday, at Sinai, when Moshe came down with the second Luchos. Today was the day Moshe was teaching us what we needed to contribute to build this building. It took them 3 days after the day of instructions to gather all that money. 3 days. And they began the construction on the 15th of Tishrei. And Hashem said, you are building a house for me. Now I will again give you your home. And this is how the Vilna Gaon explains it in his commentary to Shir HaShirim. So imagine, they do all this work, they build the Mishkan, they finish, the clouds come, incredible! God is there, we did it! And then we can't go in. Even Moshe Rabbeinu can't go in. And obviously, Hashem worked it out, that eventually Moshe could go in, Aaron could go in, Kohanim could go in, but there had to be that one moment in which they realized that what they had created with their own hands was so powerful and so real that it would bring the Shekhinah of Hashem down to such an extent that even Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest of all Nevi'im, who could speak to God panim el panim, could not enter. There has to be a moment after the as if, after saying Halakha tells us there's no such thing as something that's impossible. After we take the Shekhinah of Yom Kippur and put it into our tzchach, after we say to that tzchach, we want to sit under the wings of the Shekhinah, there should be one moment when we stand outside our sukkah on Wednesday night before we enter, when we should create in our minds the image of what that first sukkah, that first mishkan was like. That the presence of God was so real that even Moshe Rabbeinu could not enter. And if we stop for one second, when we're ready to first enter the sukkah on Sukkot, and understand that with the as if, and with the impossible, and with Yom Kippur, and with the choice to sit under the Shekhinah, the Shekhinah is so real in the sukkah, perhaps we should be afraid of entering, as Moshe was afraid of entering the Mishkan, then when we actually sit in the sukkah, we will be able to experience the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, as something that's very real. So we've spoken about approaching Sukkot now as if I can do anything, as if I can continue to be who I was in Yom Kippur, as if I could continue to daven with the intensity I daven in Yom Kippur. After we're going in with the sense of nothing is impossible, danin efshar mishalo imshar. You want to remember clouds? Build a building. A building will remind us of clouds of glory? Absolutely. There's nothing that's impossible. We experienced it on Yom Kippur. We create it when we make the choice. The Shekhinah is so real in our sukkah that we have to be careful before entering, when we're sitting in the sukkah, to feel the presence of Hashem in such a way that we speak differently when we're in the sukkah. We act differently. We eat differently when we're in the sukkah. Then we will succeed in having a sense of Shekhinah, of the Divine Presence in the sukkah. But let's go on. Because if it was the clouds, we learn halacha from the clouds. Because when is the first cloud? Before, in the second story of creation. Before Hashem created the primal human being. So it says there was no rain. All the grass, all the roots, all the shoots were underneath the ground waiting to grow, because there was not yet a human being to daven as an active participant in creation and to ask Hashem and say, it's not just that you created, but you are an active participant in your creation. Please do what is necessary for it, for everything to grow. And a mist rose, did not come down from the ground. A mist rose from the ground. And from there we learn that the sukkah, which is a recreation of the mist or cloud, must grow from the ground. That's how we learn the halakha. So this mist came and it watered the ground. Now when you have the mist, when you have mist on ground, a thick mist on the ground, what happens to the mist? It becomes mud. And Hashem took that mud, and with that mud formed the body of the primal human being. So we are not simply remembering clouds. We are remembering the first cloud. We are remembering the cloud that was used in the formation of a human being. When we recreate that mist or cloud by putting schach on top of our sukkah, we are going back to the moment of creation, to that first cloud which was used to form yitzirah, to form the body of the primal human being. Where else do we have this concept of going back to the moment of creation of the human being? There's one other place. Where else in our regular service of Hashem do we have a physical acting out of the formation of a human being? On the Mizbeah. Because in the pasuk at the end of Yisro says that the Mizbeah must be Adama, earth. But we know it wasn't made out of earth, it was made out of copper. But what was in the center of the Mizbeah? What was in the center every time they camped? What did they put there? Earth. And which earth did they put in the center of the altar to give it heft? The same earth from the same place where the primal human being's body was formed. So the Mizbeah. And the Mizbeah plays a substantial role in Sukkot also. Because what do we do, all of Sukkot, what do? We do something extra on Mizbeach we don't do the rest of the year. We pour
water.
Why are we pouring water on top of the earth that's inside of the Mizbeach? What are we doing when we're pouring water, a mist, on top of that earth, earthen Mizbeach? We are acting out the recreation or the formation of the primal human being. This is what we're doing on Sukkot when we pour the water. This is why every sacrifice we offer has to be on top of the Mizbeach, because we are going back to our very beginning, the first moments of our existence as human beings, and saying that I hope to achieve an atonement and purification with this sacrifice that will bring me back to the moment of the first moment of the formation of a human being, free of any sin, free of the Yetzer Hara that is internal. And right back to that moment, right before Adam and Chava are placed, or Adam is placed for the first time into the garden that was in Eden. So this is something else that we're doing on the Mizbeach. What else do we do with Mizbeach on Sukkot? We take the Aravos. And the Arava, we take enormous Arava branches, enormous willow branches, and we drape them over the Mizbeach so that you have a roof, schach, over the Mizbeach of Aravos. And by the way, one of the names of the seven heavens is Arava. It's one of the heavens. So think about it. You have a roof, a schach, over the Mizbeach. We're creating a sukkah over the Mizbeach. This is what we're doing when we say the Hoshanos. But it's not only that. Go back to the very beginning of creation, the first day, even before the creation of light. And the verse says, the Ruach Elohim mirachefes al pnei hamayim, that the spirit, the wind, the spirit of Hashem, so to speak, was hovering over the face of the water. And Rashi says, as a bird hovering over its nest. That in the same way a mother bird hovers over her nest in order to protect her eggs and her young chicks, in the same way the Ruach Elohim hovered over the mind, the water. This is what we're acting out when we put the Aravos at Hoshanos, when we put those Aravos and drape them as a nest, not only as a sukkah, but as a nest over the top of the Mizbeach, and we picture Hashem hovering over the top of the Mizbeach in the same way He hovered over Apnei Hamayim, the face of the water. So again, we're acting out the whole idea of water and what it represents, but not just water. We are actually acting out the first water on the very in the very first moments of creation, when Hashem is hovering, so to speak, to protect this potential, everything, the seeds and the DNA of all existence, when Hashem is there. So we have a sukkah on top of the Mizbeach. We have a nest with a mother bird hovering over. We are going back to the moment of creation. This is beyond as if. This is beyond taking something that's impossible and saying, Halakha says it's possible. This is beyond taking our experience of the Shekhinah and Yom Kippur and infusing that experience into the Schach. This is beyond the idea of living under the wings of the Shekhinah. This is beyond picturing the Anan HaKavod, the cloud of glory of the Shekhinah, filling the Mishkan so that even Moshe could not enter, and treating our Sukkah as the Mishkan at that moment. This is way beyond. This is going back to the water, the mist rising, to the very first moments of our existence as human beings. And then this goes back even further, because it goes back not only to the sixth day of creation, it goes back to the first, when Hashem hovers over, and you have the sky of Arava, as schach, leaves, as schach, over the Mizbeach, where we're pouring water, where we have the earth of creation, and we have a nest. Our sukkah and the bima and shul, when we're walking around doing Hoshanos, is like a nest. There's a nest over it, created by our Hoshanos, by our Lulavim and Esrogim. And God hovers over that nest, so to speak, to protect his creation from the very opening moments of creation. But there's much, much, much more. Are there any questions yet?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody,
is it consistent with what you're saying about the Shekhinah and the analogies of the Mizbeach to sleep in the Sukkah? For example, I've heard that the Chabad has a custom not to sleep in the Sukkah. Is it dignified? Is it giving it this the proper kavod if a person sleeps in the Sukkah?
Absolutely. And first of all, I mean, we're pretty sure it's halakha.
Yeah.
That you have to say teshu kain tadura. But when you're raising an incredibly important point, which is worthwhile to speak on for hours itself, but it's simply there's nothing we can do as human beings in our basic functions as human beings that is disrespectful of God. There's nothing we do that's disrespectful. We know that there's no place that is not filled with God's presence, which is why we even say in the bracha, after we leave ourselves, we say, Galui v'yadua lifnei chisei chavodecha. It is revealed and known in front of your throne of glory. We just relieved ourselves, and now we're speaking about the throne of glory. Because everything that exists on a physical level exists on a spiritual level as well. Sleep, that's just sleep, you're right, would be inappropriate. But sleep that is done to fulfill the mitzvah of sleeping in the sukkah, sleep that is done in order to gain the strength necessary to live a productive life of dveikus, of attachment to Hashem, is as holy as anything else. And there's nothing inappropriate about it. Nothing. And by the way, if you want to understand the idea of why we say in Ashei Yatzar, Galui v'yadua lifnei chisei chavodecha, we speak after going to the bathroom that it's known in front of the glory of God, the God's throne of glory. Just look at the story of what we did with the golden hemorrhoids that were made by the Plishtim when they returned the stolen ark to the Jewish people. So they had these beautiful wagons, and on top of these beautiful wagons, they put golden hemorrhoids to remember the hemorrhoids that God sent them. And we stored the golden hemorrhoids in the Holy of Holies.
Why?
And they were made by the Plishtim. So Rabbi Kohn will explain what that has to do with God.
Go ahead.
Okay, we started late, so I don't know.
How late to go on?
I'm sorry?
Question.
About the Hebrew. What's the Hebrew for as if, and does that reflect in the davening on Sukkot at all?
That had to have been Ellie.
I want to be in the moment, you know?
You usually are. Yes, it is in the davening. It's especially present, if you want to be in the moment, look at the first parak of Hallel. Look at the first parak of Hallel. And we find that there are different expressions for as if. It's usually called Zecher LeMigdash, which people mistakenly translate as a remembrance of the Migdash. Zecher LeMigdash means as if. If you think about it, because we act as if the Beis HaMikdash is standing. And it's an essential concept in Halacha. I would like to speak with you a little bit about water, but I don't really have time, so I'm just going to tell you the sources so that you can look it up on your own. Until what time should I go, Rabbi Kohn?
10:30. You can't ask me that question.
Okay, you know what? I'm going to do it because it's just so incredible.
Right.
It's just so incredible. This is Yechezkel chapter 47. And I'll read it in English. Please, if you have a chance, look it up. Yechezkel chapter 47. It's just look up Zechariah chapter 13. you'll find the most incredible things. We were speaking about water. What is water? So chapter 47, then God returned me to the entrance of the temple. This was in a vision. And water was emerging from under the threshold of the temple going eastward. The water ran down from under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. Then God took me out through the northern gate and led me around the outside to the outer gate. Not God. As the man left to the east with a measuring rod in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits and led me across the water, which was ankle deep. He measured another 1,000 cubits and led me across the water, knee deep. He measured another 1,000 and led me across.